The room over the chancel would do to hold magical equipment, which is bulky, and would also serve as a robing room, and the octagonal apartment under the lantern would be the temple. I had a good deal of gear already, brought over from my flat and stored in the gallery, and Mr. Maillard and I got it up those narrow stairs between us, for I did not desire the intrusion of any strangers in this matter. Aocor, Mum, Yerity M. Strong. He murmured, mopping his streaming brow after we had lifted the big mirror into position. So we got everything into position. The black walls needed nothing but varnishing to give them a luster. Upon the black floor I put a heavy black carpet to deaden sound in the room below. From the central boss hung the bronze lamp of a mosque, bearing the perpetual light, and under it stood the cubical altar that represents the universe. At the angle opposite the door I placed the great mirror for the mirror working, and between it and the altar was my long, narrow black couch like a bier for the trance work and meditation, flanked on either side by the pillars of equilibrium, the black and the silver pillars. Round the seven sides were the symbols of the seven planets. The eighth side, where was the door, represents the element of Earth and is without a symbol, for we leave Earth behind when we enter into the cosmic temple. That was all, save for the two thrones on low platforms that faced each other across the breadth of the room with the altar between them, and which are used for working in polarity. On the altar were the elemental weapons governing Earth, air, fire and water, and in front of the mirror hung the symbol of the goddess, a lunar crescent with the horns upwards. It was all very simple, no magical names or numbers, and save for the planetary symbols, no colors save black and silver, just the essentials of ceremonial magic minus all the trappings that are needed to impress the imagination of those who do not know what magical working really is. Then I sent for a friend to come and help me with the consecration. She came, and was greatly intrigued and frankly envious, openly lamenting that the exigencies of family life prevented her from discovering derelict churches and derelict cabmen and dedicating her life to the pursuit of occultism. I am always greatly amused at the manner in which outsiders expect the mysterious adept of the occult orders to live their lives. They seem to think the bow is always bent. If it is, they may take it from me that it is a fake, a theatrical property, such as little Cupid's twang in a pantomime. A good bow has a 40-pound pull, even in archery, and the tension on the whole being that launches the magical arrow is very much more than the psychic equivalent of 40 pounds. Is anyone going to pose with that bow bent for all his days and nights? It cannot be done. Something would snap. So I go in for cooking as a fine art and make my own clothes, for it has always been a tradition for the initiates to be craftsmen. A tradition that lives on even amid the lost secrets of modern masonry. It is a great temptation to use the facile shortcuts of technical terms, but if I said that my friend and I started work on the building of the astral temple, it would convey nothing. Let me therefore explain what we did and why we did it. I cannot answer for what other occultists do, especially in fiction, nor do I always know why they do it, and I sometimes doubt if they do either. I can only answer for myself and those of my own tradition. First of all, the place of magical working is a place set apart and concealed, for no one must know where it is because it is vulnerable to thought. Secondly, it has to be equipped with the symbols used in the working and nothing else, because it is a place where the mind has to concentrate. Thirdly, it has to have the astral temple built over it, and that is the really important part, and this is how we do it. We sit down and imagine it, nothing more, but, it is the imagination of a trained mind. So we sat down, my friend and I, in that dark octagonal room up in the pitch of the roof, and we pictured the Temple of Isis as we had known it near the Valley of the Kings in the great days of the cult. We pictured it in its broad outline, and then we pictured it in all its detail, describing what we saw till we made each other see it more and more clearly. We pictured the approach through the avenue of ram-headed sphinxes, the great pylon gate in the domino's wall, the court with its lotus pool, shadowed colonnades, and the great hall with its pillars. All these we pictured just as they have been in every temple of the goddess from time immemorial. And as we did this, alternately watching and describing, the fantasied scenes began to take on the semblance of objective reality and we found ourselves in them, no longer looking at them with the mind's eye, but walking about in them. After that there was no more effort of concentration for the astral vision took charge. We had gone up the avenue of sphinxes, and under the great pylon, and across the court of the lotus pool in our imagination, but we passed through the bronze doors into the great hall in actuality. Overhead hung the lamp of perpetual light that is in every temple of the mysteries. Underfoot was the circle of the zodiac inset in the marble. At the far ends of the long hall the high seats of the priests gleamed faintly, opposite us the heavy folds of a curtain concealed the Holy of Holies. Beside it, hidden in the recess of the arch, was a sloping passageway that led underground from this temple to another, a temple in the distant hills, cut out like a tomb from the living rock, and down this passage the water for the lotus pool ran in a conduit, for there was a spring in that underground temple. It was a temple of a more ancient faith than ours, being pre-dynastic. It must, I think, have belonged to the Black Hamitic people who preceded the Red Egyptian stock, for its goddess was of black basalt and her features were negroid. Before her great knees was a table altar, and there was a channel in it to take the blood, which showed that it had been used for sacrifice, and as it was of the size of a man, we knew what sacrifices it had been used for. This temple had fallen into desuetude in my day, and though there was a tradition of its existence, its entrance was lost beneath the sand and no way in remained save the underground passage known only to the senior priesthood, who knew, too, that it was back in these dark and crude beginnings that the roots of our cult drew their sustenance. It was in this temple that the higher priests were made, but still fewer knew that. The great floor of the hall stood empty, but we of the temple knew that it was not empty, for here the astral form of the mummified Isis lay as in a sarcophagus. We took our places on the thrones. My friend and I, she down at the far end on the left, and I on the high dais to the right, as befitted my status, and sitting there in the darkness, we watched, in a vision within a vision, the mummified form of great Isis become visible. Then, that part of the work finished, I said to my friend, "Ayo, shall we go to the Black Temple?" She nodded her acquiescence, and I came down from the dais and joined her before the low entrance to the underground passage. But even as I put out my hand to raise the curtain, we realized simultaneously that we were not alone. I said to my friend, "Ayo, do you see anything?" Yes, she said. "Ayo, one of the priests is here. Ayo, can you see who it is?" I said for she was a better psychic than I was. "Ayo, think it is the sacrificial priest," she said. Now the sacrificial priest would have been entitled to come with us to the Black Temple, for that was where his work lay, but he was a grim and sinister figure, and we did not particularly want him. The sacrificial priests were always priests who had committed some serious crime and who were given the chance of expiating it thus. They were shunned by the other priests, though by virtue of their office they stood high in the hierarchy, so though we did not want the company of the sacrificial priest, we could not refuse him, for he had as good a right to go to the Black Temple as we had, who were high priestesses. But as soon as we began to descend the stairs we knew there was something wrong. "Ayo, that isn't the sacrificial priest," I said, "my friend. Ayo, it is someone's astral projection. You haven't got this place properly sealed. Now I pride myself on my sealings. What I exorcise is exorcised, and stays exorcised," and I was a little inclined to be annoyed at this, for I could have sworn the seals were on. Privately I thought that she had been guilty of mind wandering, and had thought of someone, and so called him up. She apparently thought the same of me, for she said, "Ayo, did you get any break in your concentration?" "Ayo, did not," I said curtly, for this was impudence, I being very much her senior. "Ayo, well, he has to do with you, not me," she said. "Ayo, have you given anyone leave to come into the temple?" "Ayo, no one," I replied. "Ayo, do you think it is someone you intend to work with? For if you had been thinking about inviting him, even if you had not actually done it, if he is a good psychic, he might have sensed it and been able to come in." As a matter of fact, she went on, Ao got the impression that there was someone already here when we came into the Hall of the Sphinxes. I thought I saw someone kneeling and worshipping in front of the Holy of Holies. Ao, that is unlikely, I answered, for although the populace would kneel like that, a priest wouldn't, and no one but a priest could do the astral projection. My friend admitted the improbability, and we left the mystery unsolved and went down to the supper Mr. Maillard had left for us in the Great Hall. That night I dreamed, and dreamed with extraordinary vividness, that I was walking over rolling grey hills with the sea away below cliffs on my right. I was alone at first, and was enjoying my dream, when it suddenly occurred to me that I might dream of my unknown pursuer, and even as the thought passed through my mind, a dream within a dream, I thought I heard footsteps behind me, and for the first time I knew fear. I quickened my pace, and soon found myself flying over the ground in a nightmarish effort to escape, but I could hear my pursuer coming up behind, drawing nearer and nearer. I completely lost my head, but even in my panic I knew that my pursuer was not evil, and yet I fled in fear and would not let myself be overtaken. For a moment it seemed to me that the dream was beginning to turn into vision and I was about to learn something very important, when my pursuer put forth a sudden effort and caught up with me, and I felt his hand take hold of a fold of my cloak. I woke, bathed in perspiration, with the sound of my own scream in my ears. To rid myself of the horrible atmosphere left behind by this incubus, I got out of bed and went into the great hall where the remains of our supper still lay on the table, drank what was left of the milk and ate a sandwich, for there is nothing like food to close the psychic centers. The nightmarish feeling wore off. It was a warm night, and I went and sat in the window, watching the moon. I was very perplexed. All was not well with my work, I knew that. First the long delay, which showed I was off my contacts, and then the repeated penetrating of my sphere of sensation by an intruder. That it was no subconscious fantasy was shown by the fact that my friend had also perceived the presence of an intruder. I made up my mind that I would go away for a holiday, and go away at once. But next day, when I tried to put my resolution into practice, there was a most curious subconscious blocking and resistance within myself, so I abandoned it. There was more in the situation than I realized, I saw that, but there was nothing I could do save wait for it to clarify. I had been over a year now in my place of working, and had somehow settled down to accept my vigil as a matter of course. The police too had accepted my nocturnal habits as a matter of course, and for some time past, though I still dreamt of him at intervals, I had seen nothing of my pursuer. Then, one night of fog, I knew he was behind me again. I hastened, but could not throw him off, for there was no traffic to delay him at the crossings. Once, in fact, I felt him almost at my elbows as I paused on an island for a gap in the traffic. This was more than he had ever dared to do before, and if I had seen one of my policeman friends I should have stopped and spoken to him. My pursuer, however, evidently thought also that he had gone too far, and dropped behind, though I was certain he was still there, and when I came to cross Lambeth Bridge, I knew he was there, for I could distinctly hear his footsteps behind me. It was not too pleasant, being followed like that across the footbridge in thick fog, for both banks were invisible, and there was nothing to be seen save the swirling leaden water on either hand and the great chains disappearing into darkness overhead. My pursuer's footsteps rang close behind me, drawing steadily closer, and there was not another sound in all the fog-blanketed darkness. It is very easy to open the higher consciousness in a fog, for one is cut off from the world and alone with the elemental powers, and it seemed to me as I went through the darkness with the water beside me, that I was really going down the long underground passage that led to the Temple of the Black Isis, and that behind me followed the sacrificial priest. Yet I did not think that he would force me down onto the grim altar he served, but rather that he desired me. This, of course, may have been that I knew what manner of urge it is that sets men to following women through the streets, even if they mean them no harm, and it seems to me, In the strange exalted condition which was coming upon me as I fled through the darkness ahead of those pursuing footsteps, that I knew what was in the mind of the man who was following me, and that he would do me no injury, nor were the imaginings of his heart crudely evil. Perhaps I was to him a creature of dream, and he hardly realized there was a woman of flesh and blood under the cloak, to be alarmed by his pursuit. However, I arrived unmadured on the Surrey side, and made all speed for home. My wheen now led through populous streets, and I could not tell whether my pursuer were still on my heels or not, but thought not. I had my latchkey all ready to get the door open quickly, and slipped through into the warm, scented darkness of my home with a sigh of relief. But even as I did so, I felt the door thrust open behind me, and knew that my pursuer had crossed the threshold and was there inside with me, alone in the darkness. I was really badly alarmed then, for I knew that unless I kept my head I was in for an unpleasant, possibly a dangerous, experience. However, I had myself well in hand, and threw my visitor into a complete panic by turning my electric torch full on his face. Imagine my amazement, not to say disgust, when I found that he was none other than the man I had nearly run over that day in Grosvenor Road and who had played so great a part in my imaginings ever since. I realized immediately, however, that I had been right in my belief that he was not dangerous. I have never seen a man so utterly taken aback and ashamed of himself. I bid him go, and he went like a flash. I switched on the lights and entered the great hall, feeling rather shaken. It was the fog, I think, that had made the experience so alarming. I was, in fact, much more upset than I had any reason to be. For after all, the man had not been at all formidable at close quarters. Determined to get the taste of the business out of my mouth, I went up the long flights of narrow stairs to my temple up under the lantern. The lamp burnt dimly, I renewed the wick and lay down on the couch to meditate. The astral temple built up vividly and without any effort on my part, there was more power about than I had ever known before, and I saw, clearly as if it were a physical presence, the sacrificial priest lying face downwards on the floor with outspread arms in front of the curtain that shrouded the Holy of Holies. He had a right to be there, and no banishing of mine could dislodge him. Even if I had chosen to do one, I was not pleased by his presence, for that night in particular I wanted the temple to myself, but I had to put up with it. I went up to the throne and took my seat without saluting him, and he too ignored my presence, even if he were aware of it. I did my best to gather my thoughts together, for I was profoundly disturbed, most unreasonably so, I thought, and the presence of the sacrificial priest was a distraction. I wanted to be rid of him, but there came to me a very strong feeling that I must take no steps to banish him, for he was definitely part of what was afoot. This pleased me even less, for I had the instinctive aversion of the regular priesthood for the sacrificial priests, who are sacerdotal outcasts, belonging to an epoch that has passed away, and only the very advanced members of the priesthood knew their real role and significance. So I accepted the silent presence of the outcast man, and between us there presently began to be established a rapport, a feeling of comradeship, and I disliked his presence less. Then suddenly he rose and came across the temple towards me, and kneeling down at my feet, put his head on my knee in an attitude of utter submission and abandonment. He seemed like a man who was surrendering his self-respect. I laid my hand on the sensitive spot on the nape of the neck and blessed him, and as I did so, I saw that he had graying red hair and was none other than the man I had just turned from my door. But I had hardly touched him before he was on his feet again and had disappeared like a flash down the stairway leading to the Black Temple. I followed him instantly for I saw that he was insecure in his psychic projection. And what would happen to him if he got into the Temple of the Black Isis and failed to keep his concentration did not bear thinking about. We went down the long gallery beside the water, far too fast, and I found myself in the Black Temple. The man was already there, clasping the great knees of Black Isis in an agony of prayer. At all costs he must be got back into his body again. This would never do. The Black Isis is a terrific force, and how did he come to know his way into her temple? I hesitated to make the banishing pentagrams that would break the vision and force him back off the astral plane. Had he the right to be there since he was able to pass the seals I had set on my place of working and come and go apparently at will, or was the fault with me? Had that lurking stranger so shaken my nerve that my own mind wandering caused his image to be mingled with my vision? I did not know. The vision was out of control, and there was nothing to do but break it. I sat up on the black couch, badly shaken. It seemed to me that my psychism had become inextricably tangled with my subconscious content. I had come up here, to this sealed and consecrated place, for the express purpose of putting the stranger out of my mind, and here he was, part of the vision. I did not like it at all. I got off the couch, did the circumambulations and banishings again, got the incense going afresh till its clouds filled the whole room to suffocation, and lay down once more on the couch, determined to spend a night of meditation and vigil till I got the whole problem clear and cleared up. Great Isis built up, the terrible Black Isis, the source of all power, who seldom comes, and only at the great moments. I am used to her power and received it fearlessly, knowing that in a few seconds she would change into her beautiful aspect, which is so much more beautiful than anything that can be built under the symbolism of the White Isis, who is always liable to change over into the Black Isis if much power is brought through her. Therefore we who have knowledge work with the Black Isis and transmute her. This I knew, was the thing for which I had waited, though why it had delayed so long, and why it had come now, I did not know. Then it suddenly occurred to me that there was a kind of pattern running through my slowly formulating work which I had not observed before. It is well known to those who deal with the hidden side of things that such patterns exist. They are, in fact, caused by the invisible forces with which we work, and when these have been got in hand and are being directed by a planning will, the pattern appears. I knew, therefore, that if I could discern the plan of the pattern, all would be clear. There is a central thread that runs through all these things. Find that, and you have the clue. I know how to look for this thread. One seeks that which recurs and keeps on recurring. In the present instance there was one recurring factor, and one only. The man with the red hair. Like it or not, I had to accept it. I had sought my place of working in vain until I met him face to face, and very nearly offered him up as a sacrifice, and then, after one glance from his angry green-gray eyes, I had gone straight to it. Then I had entered my home and found myself unable to settle down, and had gone out beside the river, and the same man, if it were the same man, had rested his hands on his windowsill and stared at me across the water. It might have been that I was visible to him, for I was wearing a white linen dress against a dark background and the last light was on me. Anyway, from that moment I entered into peaceful possession of my new home and the power began to build up. Then, walking behind me on the embankment, he managed to enter into my dream, but I would not look over my shoulder at this intrusive stranger, and so nothing came through to the physical plane, for it seemed as if that could only happen when I met I, and I remembered how all those who work with the unseen forces attach great importance to the glance of the eye. Finally, in that night of fog he drew close to me, entered my house, met me face to face, and I turned him away like a stray dog. I remembered vividly the way in which he went. Bewildered, confused, ashamed. No, that man knew nothing, nothing consciously, at any rate. But there are more levels of the mind than the conscious one, and I knew that there was both knowledge and power lying latent in him. This was no ordinary man, even so far as the mundane plane was concerned. That fine head and those beautiful hands told me that. Who he was, what he was, I did not know, but that he was a Sambodhyaya I knew for certain. This pleased me, for I like achievement. I wondered, too, how far he knew that there was something afoot. Was I mingling with his dreams even as he was with mine? Did he identify me with the woman who had so nearly run him down and made a casualty of him? If so, his first impressions must have been just as unfavorable as my own. He had thought me a fool, that was obvious, in fact he had said as much. Moreover, I judged he was one of those men who disapprove of makeup, and I had that day been using coral lipstick and cardinal nail lacquer. My right hand was ungloved, for I was wearing a garnet marquise ring on my forefinger over which no glove would go, and he had had a good view of it, resting on the steering wheel, as he had laid hold of the door of my car and given me a piece of his mind. Yes, I certainly must have startled the gentleman on every plane of his being. Then there was the last scene of all, and I wondered whether it was indeed the end of this strange eventful history, the scene within my doorway in the dark, when I flashed my torch in his face and drove him forth, ashamed and disgraced. It would certainly be the last scene of all, and end of the play, unless there were indeed an underlying bond to bind us one to the other, for no man would risk the renewal of such an experience. There would be no more shadowing on the embankment, I was perfectly certain, in fact the man would run a mile at the sight of me. How, in view of all this, could I make any sort of contact with him, or enter into any sort of rational relationship, let alone explain to him what was afoot and induct him into the part he had to play? There was only one way I could do it, I knew that, only one way that was safe and right, the true way of the tradition. I must pick him up psychically on the astral, and let matters work out in their own way on the physical plane. Then I should know that I was on the right track and had made no mistake in my chosen priest. I must sit still and wait, a year, 5 years, it did not matter, in the end, if he were the chosen man, he would come. The call had to come through to him from the inner planes, it had to work through from his inner consciousness to his outer consciousness and could not be forced. He had to realize it for himself, and God only knew against what resistances of prejudice, convention, preconceived opinions, and even downright fear it would have to prevail, for people are often afraid of ISIS. Very well, I thought, we will pursue the age-old policy, on the outer plane, passivity, on the inner plane, come. So I called my priest to me on the inner planes, and on the inner planes he came. He was the sacrificial priest beyond any question. I wondered what history lay behind him and what expiation lay ahead. He came, and he was simply all to pieces. I felt very sorry for that man. He had reached the point when he was at the end of his tether. He was certainly not a man to thank anybody for sympathy, but he was at the end of his tether, this man, and he knew it, and I knew it. Unless something were done for him, he would break up completely. Men of his type are like that if their shell is once penetrated. So I projected by means of the astral projection which takes out so much of the etheric that it is visible even to the non-psychic. It is a dangerous thing to do, especially over water, for water absorbs astral emanations. I projected my mind, clothed in the body of light, to that room across the river I had once seen lit up and crossed and recrossed by a restless shadow. Yes, I had not been misled. There was my man right enough, nor had I been mistaken as to his condition. Ayo, this must be coped with, I said to myself, or I shall not only lose my priest, but hurt and injure this man very badly. So I set to work, with my knowledge and with my power, I, the priestess of Isis. For my own sake, I would not have done it, nor do I think I would even have done it for his sake. For in those days he was nothing to me, but I did it for the sake of Isis because she needed him for her work. Chapter 7. I will tell what I did, putting my cards on the table, for it shows how we use the door without a key to escape the Lord of this world, who is Moloch, and take refuge in the secret kingdom, which is the dark side of the moon, the side she turns away from Earth. The door without a key is the door of dreams, it is the door by which the sensitive escape into insanity when life is too hard for them, and artists use it as a window in a watchtower. Psychologists call it a psychological mechanism, magicians call it magic, and the man in the street calls it illusion or charlatanry according to taste. It does not matter to me what it is called, for it is effectual. I made the astral projection by the usual method, That is to say, I pictured myself as standing 6 feet in front of myself and then transferred my consciousness to the simulacrum thus created by my imagination and looked at the room through its eyes. Then I visualized the face of the man with the graying red hair, and imagined myself speaking to him. The magic worked.